to you introducing the show.
Oh, was I meant to introduce the show? I think when we do the Robert thing.
No, I said you start.
Oh, okay. Well, here we are. Here we are. Another cold open for Wrecked Radio. KBM not here. He's normally the person who starts it up. He's out there. Did you see his video today? He's like on the island, the Komodo Island. I saw
him. Yeah, I did see that.
And some dragons. So he couldn't make it today. I think he's having the time of his life. So it's just me and OSF. And actually, we have a third Brit. Fully Brit, living in the US, I guess. You for a while. So there's going to be three Brits on stage shooting the shit, I guess, for the next hour or so. OSF, do you want to take it away with our sponsor? And then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So as you guys know, this show is sponsored by Rollbit, one of the largest crypto casinos out there. You can do anything from sports gambling, crypto futures trading, NFT borrowing, lending, trading, casino games, etc. All the degen activities are on rollbit.com or rollbot.com, depending on your jurisdiction. As usual, we'll have two codes to give away. So the first code that we have is JackB9246. JackB9246. And I've put that on the YouTube stream as well. So if you guys want to watch the show on video, check out the YouTube link that's on the pinned post of the space. And there we go. That's the sponsor.
So how are you doing otherwise? What have you been up to? Life is on, it feels like, for you.
I like how you ask me these questions as if we like haven't spoken for a week. We'll literally just speak to you.
Yeah, pretty much 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But we might as well shoot the shit and say what we have been up to. You seem like you're top degenning. Like you've your Milady arc has really come through over the last couple of weeks.
I mean, there's nothing going on. Like, there's not really anything going on in NFTs, nothing going on in major. So you just look for where there's activity and where there's actually some volatility. And that right now that's in shitcoin. So I've just, away from like all the art stuff and retro stuff we've been doing, I've just been shitcoin degenning basically, which is.
And there's money to be made.
There's money to be made. Yeah, there's definitely money to be made.
Way more money than majors.
Yeah, you have to be smart about taking profits, I think, and getting out at the right time. Otherwise, you can just really gap to zero. You have to be very, very disciplined. But if you can apply that, then there's a lot of money to be made.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's not something to fade. I think this is something that's going to be around for the foreseeable future, in my opinion. I can just feel it. Like everything's moving on chain. I think the on-chain narrative is going to be a big one for the medium term. Yeah, I think we'll be shitcoining until Christmas. That's what I reckon.
Shitcoining.
It feels like that way. Like genuinely, I don't think anything's going to go on in majors. I think it's like the lowest volatility period right now for majors. So even if you've like maxed up levered trading, and that's across shitcoins. I mean, you can do Pepe, the whole plethora of shitcoins, it seems like you can trade. Anyway, let's get into it because I think Jack Butcher has been one of the breakout stars of this year. And it would be, which maybe you were last year. Who knows? Maybe it's handing off the mantle.
I'm a poor man's. last year was a poor man's version of Jack Butcher this year.
So. Yeah, you're like a mixture of a poor man's Frank and a poor man's Jack Butcher. Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, let's get him up here. Let's get the man up here.
Hello, gents. How are we? Can you hear me?
We can. Yeah. Yeah.
Doing well. How you doing, man?
Good. 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 Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries. So yeah, the theme of the show is really about risk taking. But we kind of just felt like you were the person to speak to anyway because you've been all over this year, and we've both been tracking your progress and kind of been a bit of a meteoric ride, but it'd be cool just to hear your backstory and everything. So we thought we'd get you on. But firstly, congratulations for this year. Like it's been nuts. Like yeah, I think you first came onto our daily show in January or February, when Peppin was launching. Was that around the same? Is that the right timeline? Have I got it there?
I think that was. I think we talked about checks maybe February-ish.
Yeah, February.
Yeah, yeah.
That was it. And then it's just. You've just gone from strength to strength. How's this year been for you, like mentally and physically? Like it must have been a joke.
It's been taxing in a lot of different ways, but obviously incredible in many others. Yeah, those first few months in particular, we had our second kid 4 days before checks. The original open edition, which at the time wasn't planned to go any further than that. But the first, yeah, I mean, up until now, really, but the first 4 months or so was absolutely insane with a newborn in the house too. But we're kind of getting some balance back now.
And it's a small team, right? It's just you.
Me, Phil, on the smart contract back end stuff, and much of the front end stuff, and Traf as a UI front end designer all round. Yeah, just
a couple of
supremely talented partners.
Do you have like Discord modes, or like are you them? Do you have to be
no.
Like,
so we never launched anything on the community front, quote unquote, officially for Checks and OPEPM, but the visualized value business before any of this stuff had a Discord community, but it hasn't, like, that's a totally different onboarding experience that comes through a bunch of education products. So no, it's just we're just working on the projects themselves, not assigning anyone full time to work on community stuff. A lot of it, I think a function of that has been great is a lot of that happened in public for that reason, because you didn't build this private environment. A lot of the momentum I think that built up during January and February could be attributed to people just doing it on Twitter as opposed to in a Discord somewhere.
Yeah, it's massively impressive. Like, I think the fact we're a small team as well, and we have a few projects, but we kind of keep stuff a bit more chilled, I think, than you do. It's kind of impressive to see how much you've managed to roll out and all the expectations and all this sort of stuff that's been going on. Like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, just kind of responding to momentum and having done stuff on the internet for the last 4 or 5 years now, this idea that when you have eyeballs or you have this momentum building, you have, I wouldn't say like you're completely obligated to act within that time frame, but it definitely helps. So we probably overstretched ourselves quite a bit in the first few months for that reason, just because it felt like there was an outsized amount of attention, and losing that, obviously, that's so much a part of the game of anything that's internet native, is maintaining that attention. So also try to learn from that and kind of bake that into how the projects work too over time.
So should we roll it back a little bit? Like, tell us about yourself before you Checks, before OPEPM, before you were in NFTs. Like, how did you get started in the design world, and then how did you make that transition into the stuff you're doing now, but also, like the ideas that you've kind of come up with? And it feels like the stuff that you have now are productions of ideas that you've maybe had for longer amounts of time or whatever. So I'm just curious to hear, like, what you're doing before, B, when did you start formulating these ideas in your head, and what was it that you originally envisaged for them?
So my background is I grew up in the UK, studied graphic design. 2010, I graduated and immediately got an internship in a little design studio in London. I was commuting back and forth from Swindon. You boys will know that, but maybe a lot of people listening won't. But so it was like a 3-hour commute each way for about 2 months or something during the summer after I graduated. And actually met two guys in a Wetherspoons one night in Swindon. who had a connection at Virgin Atlantic, and they're like, we can get flights to New York for 70 quid, I think it was at the time. And I was like, all right, count me in. And so I went to an internship. I was like, I have the opportunity to go to New York. Maybe I'll be back in 3 months, whatever, the tourist visa thing. And then as that like departure date was getting closer, I was like, maybe I should try and meet some people in the design world when I'm in New York. So I think the Google search I did was like design internships, New York. I got Craigslist as the first result, emailed every single listing on that Craigslist page. And most of it was like, designing flyers for car washes or whatever it was at the time. And I got one response from this guy who was like an ex Madison Avenue creative director who started his own shop in West Chelsea in New York. He's like, yeah, come in and I'll sort of show you the ropes. And I like your book of work from university. And that just turned into like a proper job eventually. Like he sponsored me and brought me over there. I did 7-8 years bouncing around the agency scene in New York, just all sorts of different stuff. That was like a tiny little boutique shop. So we'd do branding projects and we had a little Ralph Lauren deal where we'd shoot magazine, like photographs for magazines for Ralph Lauren, stuff like that. So it was like totally surreal from what I was doing before. And then just kind of got exposure to all these different agency jobs in New York, big places, little places, boutique firms, like big consulting agencies. I worked in startups, did UI design, just basically every commercial application of design you could think of. I'll just get bored after 6 or 9 months and just want to get a different job. And then finally started my own thing late 2017, an agency. I had a supercar client as my first client, which I thought was like, that was, you know, I thought I was set on that. Huge car guy. So I was like, for about 6 months, driving around the country, shooting car commercials. Very fun, but like burned out to even probably worse than earlier this year. That burnout is insane. Trying to basically compete with Fortune 500 agencies by yourself. You just have to do like 10, 12 jobs. So decided not to take that route and then went the fully online route quickly after that. So a couple of different pivots, but ended up with this service business called Visualize Value, where I would basically take somebody or a business or a product that has something that's really difficult to explain, turn it into 10, 12 simple visuals that somebody could stand in front of a crowd of people and deliver a pitch of some kind. So I did a lot of like fundraising materials, did explainers for product sites, stuff like that. Anybody that had something that they found difficult to explain. And in the process of building that, I started this Instagram and Twitter page basically as lead gen. So at Visualize Value on Instagram or Twitter would get me these consulting clients, service businesses, mostly service businesses. And then got to the point where I just couldn't fulfill all the work that was coming in inbound from the stuff I was posting. And I was like, oh, I should make an education product. So I made a design, like a design curriculum, how to take an idea and distill it into something. Visual, that's where the online community started to spin up, launched a couple of other education products. One was about like this like meta idea of how do you take your skill set and turn it into an education product in the first place. And then the third one was called Permissionless Apprentice, which is actually how I met Jalil, which is, I think it's 40 little short lessons, but basically if you're trying to work on the internet, how do you just go out and produce things that bring opportunity to you? And that just meet like, all the people that material attracted into the Discord. That's how I discovered what Ethereum was, what an NFT was, because people were like, oh, you've been producing digital art for 2 or 3 years now. Why don't you do this? And the first time I saw it, I went, OpenSea was the link someone gave me. And I was like on there, like, what is this? I don't get it. And that was probably at the time where you could, you know, buy a CryptoPunk for 50p or something. It was like mid 2020. And maybe not that cheap, but cheap. And it wasn't until I was introduced to Foundation, you know, the one of one platform Foundation, that I like it really clicked. I was like, oh, this is just the digitally native Christie's or Sotheby's, right? The curation, the invitation, the way in which your work is presented and how people can interact with it. So that's where I started, minted my first one of one on Foundation in March of 2021, I believe. And just took that same philosophy of how do I take these ideas that are interesting to me and put them through this filter of what became known as Visualize Value, which is this black and white monochromatic aesthetic. And that really lent itself to all of these concepts that NFTs were unpacking, you know, social contracts, value, digital art, ownership, provenance, all of that stuff. So that gave me all this fuel to create these one of ones, and had a great response to that. had the business that I was already working on. And 2022 came around and everything was kind of quiet, nothing going on. So I was still publishing work, still, but it just did not seem like a viable thing to, you know, rely upon solely. So I was back to operating the other business quite a bit. And then the checks thing kind of came out of nowhere. As you know, I'm reading all the Elon stories. I'm like unhealthily addicted to Twitter, as I'm sure many of people who are on there listening to this. And that image was just the original checks open edition image was really like a commentary on all the things that I've been thinking about and stewing over for a year or so. And then the momentum that came from that open edition really just created this canvas to do all of the things that I'd been thinking about before, where publishing these one of ones and building a collector base like one at a time is really difficult to get that network effect and to continue to grow this thing. So as soon as that felt like it became viable by the fact that people were already participating in it, and this open edition, like the normalization of it, or the like opportunity to figure it out as you go and write publicly about how you're thinking about it, really was, it just created this, like I said, a canvas to put all the things in practice that I'd been curious about, thinking about all these years prior, and fortunately had, you know, people I was connected to that could help me build that stuff too, because that's not my skill set. I'm really spending much more of my time thinking about the why of this stuff and then, you know, figuring out how it gets built or translated to lines of code is something that I need help with for sure.
I was gonna say it's interesting because in the world of art, the things that become get really big or massive, and setting, you know, same thing for NFTs really, are things that capture like a moment in time that's like a piece of a snapshot of culture or a thing that a large amount of people can resonate with. And I think that's been the case for like lots of different newer forms of art within the last century. And, you know, with the checks thing, when it came out, it was just like, there's not a single person who's on Twitter or on social media who looks at that and doesn't get it. Do you know what I mean? Like right. Every single person gets it because it just, you were able to like, in such a simple single image, you're able to just like snapshot this feeling that millions, probably hundreds of millions, if mm-hmm. not billions of people had, which is why I think that was so brilliant. And this idea of it being an open edition at the same price at which the Twitter Blue subscription was, just like was genius really. But when you created that, when you did it, you must have had a good feeling about it when you're doing that. Hey, this is a great idea, so I'm going to go do it. But did you, sometimes when you do these things, you just know it's going to be like a massive winner. Sometimes you don't really know. Like, did its success catch you off guard, or were you expecting some success but not as much as that? Like, how are you feeling?
Just, I think so.
You know, when you hit go, like, how are you feeling about it?
You know, I think the surprising thing was the genesis of that idea was actually in a one of one from years before called NFTs Explained, where I had the JPEG and the NFT next to each other with the blue check up on the top right of the NFT. So that always been this symbol that to me is almost more suited to Ethereum NFTs, like decentralized consensus, than, you know, the Twitter top-down assignment of this thing. So that thing really resonated. That image, when I put it out originally, had, I don't know how much, I didn't even have view statistics back then, but 18,000 likes, 19,000 likes, something like that. And my accounts were way, way smaller back then. And the crazy thing about this one is I think the number of mints exceeded the likes on Twitter by a factor of 16 or something, which is kind of a crazy concept. And a nod to the idea of like network effects that have like economic signals attached to them, right? There's some people who are obviously buying that because they want to collect the image, and there's other signals that are being sent across the network that this image is interesting to this many people, so maybe other participants come in for that reason. And I think I wasn't paying that much attention to the rest of Twitter at that point. I'm like retroactively trying to think through how it came to be. And there was like the last week of December. just about to have another kid. And I was realizing every time I go on Twitter, I was like reading all this depressing stuff. I was like, I have to get rid of some of these accounts I'm following. I went and did this massive cleanse of, I don't know, the zero hedge and the recommended follows that come with that. I was like, I'm just going to take this off a feed for a couple months. And maybe that surfaced a bunch of these artistic experiments of the open edition meta that got my head working on that problem a little more. But after the original thing, I genuinely had no intention to build on it more than that, like zero. And then it's like this dance where you wonder whether or not people's excitement isn't necessarily coming from your intent to make an artistic statement early on, right? It's not, a lot of it is like this chicken and egg thing where you putting more energy into this thing potentially makes it more valuable, which obviously you're going to get great feedback on. So that idea of building it out in public or tinkering with it was, I can't fully attribute that one way or the other, but I got super excited about it after maybe in just a couple of days of realizing how far you can take it because it was so structured and the response that people had when they started remixing it, which to me is so much of what all of this is about. You know, it's like creating these moments in time that people can participate in. And it also been something that in building all the educational stuff in visualized value, I'd seen so many creative people face this cold start problem, especially if you're an artist or, you know, you have some like visual output that can't plug into a network of sorts, and NFTs don't necessarily solve that problem, but the energy that surrounds the network gives you a much higher chance of creating something that is associated with something that people already care about. So all of that energy was informing it. There wasn't like a direct, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and this is how it's going to turn out. It was a back and forth with how people were responding to each thought that I was publishing.
And how did the OPEPIN stuff come about? Because I think you launched that at a similar time to Chex, and obviously Chex was like the one that captured the mainstream attention, and you know, you came back and were really creative with OPEPIN to get that going. But what was the thoughts and ideas behind that one? Was it just like a fun project to start with and then kind of more?
Yeah, it wasn't even that to begin with. It was, so you guys will know Bats Do, right? He had geometric Pepe series on Foundation, I think a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And there's all these just funny layers and references at the time. Like the OPEPIN edition was the name of the contract too, because I'm playing with the idea of open edition.
Yeah.
His geometric style, obviously the reference to Pepe, the mimetic character of the internet. And it just went out for an hour and I was like, oh, this is a cool little moment in time to capture and leave it be. Then that, you guys will remember this too, like at the beginning of the year, it's just like every time you tweeted, people be under the tweet, like, when are you doing something with this? When are you doing something with this? And I just thought, like, I'm not going to do anything with that. It just doesn't make sense. I don't have any ideas for what to do. And then just felt like after a certain amount of time, I guess my curiosity or just wanted to see how far I could push it. And just seeing the way Chex played out, being the medium of that or the way in which that was shared doesn't have the same exposure as something that could be used as an identity, which obviously a bunch of the NFT momentum has been maintained by the fact that people can use them as their identities and display them 100,000 times over Twitter every day. So there's always been something interesting about like, oh, what would it be like to experiment with a project in that world? But it was a 60-minute open edition mint, so it was free, and it was not economically viable to turn it into a project of any kind. But it was just so much momentum around it that was like, oh, let's just do it and see, we'll figure it out down the road. And then all of these mechanics, it was like 2 months of back and forth thinking about, yeah, you could do some like, you know, one application for it and let it run, and you know, that would be the end of that. But a lot of the stuff that I learned in putting checks out, I think was rolled into the mechanics of a pep and to try and maintain more attention than a lot of the stuff, you know, you've seen the charts straight up and straight down and then sideways.
So can you just give us like a bit of background on what you have out there right now? I know you said that you had all these different things to experiment with. I know you've got checks, you've got a Pepin, there's like the originals, there's the VV edition. Like what are the different narratives you're kind of going forward with? And maybe then we can go into like what else you're thinking about.
Yeah, so there's the foundation one of ones. That's basically the groundwork for all this stuff. And then checks, there's two collections. The first is checks editions, which are essentially the original token that was minted in that that open edition mint back in January. But we built this secondary functionality where you can migrate the edition over to a new contract. And in doing that, you create this completely on-chain unique, check. So you go from this, you know, one of 16,000 to one of one with a completely unique characteristics. And then there's the ability to composite those together in the originals collection. So you combine two of what we call an 80 check, which is the full grid. It becomes a 40 check. Two of the 40s become a 20. Two 20s become a 10, et cetera, et cetera. Take 64 of the original editions to create a one check. 40 people have done that. And then this is definitely better explained with visuals, but then 64 one checks can be composited to create what we call the black check, which is 4,096 original editions, which is a third of the supply, which, you know, just creates this almost infinite game where that's a super hard thing to accomplish and would require an insane amount of either force or cooperation. So this is like the meta commentary on, you know, the pursuit of status and how that plays out. And then Opepin is a single collection that's still running off the off that original open edition mint, but we just introduced some mechanics that sit on top of that. So the rarity has already been assigned across those 16,000. We've basically extrapolated this numeric system from the checks and had that applied to the rarity within Opepin, and it creates 200 micro collections of 80 pieces. So there's 200 collections within Opepin. They're 80 tokens each. So the entire collection is 16,000 pieces. And this idea of consensus is something that we explore with that. So the silhouette was developed completely in public. We arrived at this really simple geometric shape. And then we present art and people opt in or out of the drop for each 200. And that determines whether or not that art gets released. So that every, you know, those 200 intervals where basically the community decides what the artwork is going to be. And then that gets locked in and revealed on 80 tokens at a time. So we just did our 11th drop as a collab with Pudgies. We got 191 drops left.
I love
189,
it.
89, I should say. Sorry.
It keeps shit. I mean, I think part of the issue about NFTs, maybe it's not an issue, but you know, once you put something out there, it's forever. And once it's successful, like you just said, it's like you need to keep that narrative going for a long time. Like it can have an end game, but to a large extent, it's got to still have that attention economy aspect to it. And that can be a straitjacket at the same time. Like, I don't know how you feel about this, Ovi, but like you couldn't just do like another rec guy, for example. Like it's just like it's very tough once you've got something out there. If you, as a creative, you've got to think, right, I've got to kind of see this for a while. Like this is a concept that's actually going to probably last for a year, maybe longer. And if I move away from it, somehow you're like you're a rugger, or somehow
right.
Like, you know, you can be seen as like diluting the supply and all this sort of shit, which is just so anti, I think, how creative people are.
Yeah. It's the opposite. Yeah.
But I think it's really smart how you've done it, because I think with each of those, you can see an end game. And I like, you know, the updating of the metadata stuff with the checks keep stuff fresh. And it's kind of similar to how you have your RLD, Ovi, but but it's not like a monthly drop. It's just like it's a change in narrative without inflation, I guess.
It's gamified too, isn't it? I think that's what makes it interesting. It's like, and then you see, I like on the Apepin one, I really like how when you guys do the drop, you not only show like whether it's been approved or not, but you have like the amount it's oversubscribed by or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, mm-hmm. you can see like the bats one was like, oh, there's like 16,000% like oversubscribed, right, or whatever. And people are like, oh shit, like this one's going to be a good one. Or it's going to be like, it kind of gives you an idea of like what the price might be before you actually have a price for it, because you have like a metric for the demand, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's that in both of these projects, what we're trying to do is take advantage of the technical capabilities of the underlying infrastructure, the idea of consensus or custody in the case of checks. Like they're playing with the same ideas, but almost in an opposite function. Like the compositing in checks is this completely final, like predetermined, the code is written and it's deterministic from this point forward. And this, the Pepin story is really community controlled, and the way in which the story travels around Twitter actually determines who might contribute to a set. We just built a set submission tool a couple of weeks ago where anybody can go in and upload 6 pieces of artwork, soon to be 80 pieces of artwork that they would like to submit and cryptographically sign. So again, it's this like permissionless, community vetted, all of these different themes. And sometimes they don't work either. I think that's the cool thing about it too, is people ask for certain things and then you can show them, here's what you asked for. And it turns out the net demand for this thing is not as high as you would have expected. And it's taking that idea of getting feedback in real time to another level. It's not try and understand what people want, then go away and build it. It's show them the thing. And then if they decide they want it, it either gets released or it gets scrapped. So I think it's not the most economically viable model in the short term, because you obviously just, there's so much work on us to do. But I think, I'm personally in a position to do it because visualized value already exists. And this is like a fun project that can be, you know, built in unison with the things that are much more sustainable from an economic perspective. So that's a helpful position to be in too.
Visualized value is still going strong then? You haven't fully accepted your degen NFT roots?
It does still exist. I think there's also a personal pendulum swing there too, whereas like the barbell of like education products and like slow principled things, and then there's the, you know, throwing things at Twitter and in real time having feedback and working on an art project. So there's been times where I'm like, I just need to abandon the whole thing. But I do think that bouncing back and forth between those two things is actually good for the mind as well, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's 100% true. And then I think that's also good for what we just said as well. Like, you can't always release stuff in NFTs because mm-hmm. you might want to be creative, but you can't do it because you know it's just going to be seen as dilution, or it doesn't really hit the bar. So then you can do stuff maybe outside, which has less of an impact.
Yes, interesting whether or not we'll see this stuff become more traditionally consumable, because I feel like maybe fashion is a good analogy. If you're, you know, Louis Vuitton and you have 16,000 units to ship a year, or 100,000 or whatever it might be, the transparency almost kills some of these brands. You know, if they were transparent about the supply of their product, it would be perhaps detrimental. I don't know. Maybe the market finds its way, or maybe fashion is a more consumable thing. But the problem, I guess, or the really difficult challenge is the requirement to be current, or the strong incentive to be current, or you produce something that is like forever Lindy after, you know, the first couple of years of things have almost been cemented as the like untouchable executions of blockchain art, very, very hard to do, right? Versus, yeah, behaving more like a fashion company where you produce things that are in lockstep with culture and that kind of accrues attention back to the entire collection over time. You're in a bit of a bind if you have to do that without ever increasing the supply of product.
Yeah. So let's go one route, which is you were there towards the start of all of NFTs, it sounds like, or at least in early days.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a degen at heart? Are you a collector? Did you get involved? I remember hearing that you were in the Punks chat very early on, and that's how like a few people knew of you. But were you a big holder?
Yeah,
of
Punks? I wouldn't say a big holder. I was a little too late to the party to be a big holder. I had two at one point.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So I collected a bunch of stuff. I got involved in a lot of one-on-one stuff on Foundation originally when I was just like seeing who else was dipping their toes into this world, and then got dragged into the collectible stuff very quickly, like the big PFP collections. Bored Apes was one of my first, maybe 2 or 3 days after Mint saw that. And just like that was another light bulb moment that was very different than the Foundation one-of-one light bulb moment. It was like, I was on the playground, marbles, pogs, Pokemon cards, you know, all of the every trend that came through school while I was there, I was deep into that stuff. So intrinsically, I think understood the potential of the networked collection where you could see the supply and there's these like social games happening on something like Twitter, which was also a place I'd spent a bunch of time before I knew what any of this stuff was. Figuring out how to make images go viral or reach a lot of people or build equity in a brand. I published 2,000 visualized value images at that point, had maybe 500,000 followers across Instagram and Twitter on just for visualized value, and just kind of instantly clicked on the collectibles front how that would translate to these things getting popular. So played around with the Bored Ape stuff, had a few of those. And then actually when I went to the first NFT NYC, maybe not the first, but the first big one, you remember where there's the long line, infamous meme video. I was like, I don't know how. At that point I was like, all right, this is like I'm looking at the value of this thing. I was like, this is insane. The mismatch here is so insane. How can you deliver on that valuation? So that was where I was like, okay, I'm going to de-risk a little bit of that, and started paying way more attention to the what I would consider less execution risk art side of things, art blocks, and some like just great satirical collections. Like I was big Lava Lads, huge Lava Lads enjoyer. Also, I get into back.
So then. You sold your Bored Ape and bought Lava Lads.
Oh yeah, I went crazy on Lava Lads. Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, that, and a couple one-on-one artists, one that just came into one that just started collaborating, or set six of OPEP and Piv. He's got a collection called Punkism. I love his stuff. And I got a couple X copy editions and Squiggle, and you know, I've been playing around in this world for a few years, but haven't built the collection that I would love. But also I feel like the balance of building stuff and collecting stuff at the same time is incredibly difficult. And they're like different mentalities that you're like reading versus writing. It's like switching modes. So last year, after I produced a bunch of one-on-ones, that's when I sort of went on the collecting spree. And this year it's been just making stuff. As much as there's stuff that I see and I'm like, oh man, I wish I was more plugged into that world, but haven't been as much this year.
It does open doors, I find. Like even when we've had projects, and like you just by staying collecting, I feel like we've met so many artists, and I'm not even a fucking artist, but I've met a ton of artists by being a collector, and I know that's helped us. Like how you just said for number seven, he was an artist that you collected. We got involved in a few different artists that way. Alien Queen, for example, was kind of something that we collected, and then it kind of happened that way. So it is I do find it very useful to try and still open up that 100%. DJ side.
No, 100%. I think like after the collectible stuff, my everything I've bought is just going to be, I'm just going to hang on to it forever. You know, like the idea of translating the experience I've had back as a collector of work is definitely, it's definitely different than I thought about it 2 years ago. It's more of a, like, I've also seen people just slow down the amount of work they produce or mint, or that, like, this is another like paradox of a slow market is, you know, as an artist, this is now the time to put a body of work out there and build this momentum and story. And when that gets discovered, there's so much more depth to it than waiting for a moment in time where it feels like, you know, the market is telling you to do something versus putting this thing out because you just want to have it out in the world. So, like I could definitely spend more time on that. It's a,
You need to take a break, man. You need to take a break.
I know. I'm stretched, man. It's been a crazy year.
Talking, I mean, not to push it now, but what, we've just spoken about how those three or four projects you have going on right now, you can kind of see how they're all going to develop over time. Are you thinking about new things? I saw like an open edition the other day. I know it didn't go great from a tech standpoint, but have you got a bunch of ideas you're thinking about for the next 12 months, or are you just going to really slow it down?
Well, you're going to reship that thing. So that's Infinity was that was a project that we intended the initial launch of to be this like no speculation mechanism. I'm in the wrong place to talk about this, but the idea being that this is a refundable, redeemable NFT, right? So it's a generative, piece that can have an infinite supply, and at any point, any collector can return it for the ETH they spent on it. So what this does, in my mind, if you want to look at it at a really pragmatic level, is you're not diluting the supply because there's no upside baked into this. So you're not like creating this volatility, but you are expanding the number of people that can participate in the ecosystem without those potential negative side effects. So I feel like this is part of the next chapter or the thing that people are trying to popularize or take steps towards popularizing is collecting for collecting's sake at a lower price point where you can join a network of people who are interested in similar things to you. And that is worth, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks to participate in versus perpetuating the myth that every digital asset is going to exponentially increase in value. That is obviously just economically impossible. And I think that, you know, the laws of economics just slowly catching up with this world. And obviously you have to create and deliver incredible things to ask anybody to part with their well-earned cash. So in my mind, the mechanic that we developed is like a response to that. It's like how that gets interacted with is going to make a statement in itself. You know, if nobody does that, then it implies that, or if a tiny percentage of people do that, there is no reason to do that other than to collect the artwork. So if nobody does it, then it makes a statement by in the opposite direction. So
have you given the alpha about what this is? I guess I'm trying to read between the lines.
Oh, it's called Infinity. So we launched it a couple of weeks ago, and there was an exploit in a smart contract.
No, I remember that. But yeah, like what's it going to be? And I know you're talking about in terms of like concepts there, but is there any alpha on like what?
No.
No. Nothing yet.
No, I think by the end of the week we should have it figured out.
Okay, cool. All right, we'll look forward to it. Yeah. I know you're. I get what you're saying, trying to solve for the concept, but I guess that sounds cool. So that's going to be your next thing for the next few months, I guess.
Yeah, that's the plan. Yeah, and then obviously 189 more drops on the Pepin front to figure out.
I wanted to ask, through this whole process, I think from the outset, it just kind of looks like you guys have crushed it. And I think all the commentary and stuff and the stuff that you put out in terms of marketing and tweets, etc., they just seem very like, they have this aura of like confidence, or like, you know, there's a plan all the time and you guys know what you're doing, and, you know, it's all just very smooth and slick. And I think that's obviously part of the branding that you've also created with Visualize Value and that kind of stuff, this idea of like clean, smooth, seamless, zero friction, like very aesthetic, like, mm-hmm. the whole operation seems very slick. But I wanted to ask, if we go like behind the scenes, like what are the moments in the last 12 months where you've had challenges or found something difficult with respect to the stuff that you're doing? Like, what's been like, you know, the points where you've been like, oh shit, like this is tough, or that really sucked, or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. like there must be moments like that. I'm sure it's not all slick behind
the scenes. No, for sure not. No. Like that I guess is the stuff that gets published is like the resolution of the jumbled mess in your head, you know, that really is just, if anything, that stuff is proof that there is a struggle behind the scenes, you know. It's like getting things down to something that is distilled in a way, or that feels like it's the solution to something. On the back end, there is a lot of like, what's the meme of the duck pedaling underwater? You know, it's like float the swan. The swan's going over the water, but the legs are going nuts. Yeah, I think a couple of very distinct ones. Obviously, last week we had an expensive error in that smart contract. I think we had an incredible response from people on that front. And I am making the assumption that that comes from us being transparent up until this point, and in, you know, refunding everyone fully for that mistake. But at the same time, it's like crushing to not have caught that beforehand. And then there are other things where the Pepper mechanics particularly was a crazy one, where it's just like making the suggestion that we're going to turn that into something new while figuring out exactly how that's going to work was definitely, there were like moments along that journey where I was like, oh man, I might have to go back on some of those decisions and maybe not develop this in the way I thought I was going to. There's also been some of the sets we've released where I felt like I'm really confident about this and the response is not what I would hope for, at least early on. So a lot of the early feedback on stuff, and if you're presenting something to 200 and however many thousand people at a time, somebody's not going to like it. And just trying to build things that are interesting to a smaller number of people within that 200,000 is how you have to think about it. You know, it's like, you're not really designing this stuff for 500,000 people. There's 4,000 people, 5,000 people that hold these pieces across both collections. So, yeah, just trying to remember that there's a lot of it is your own taste too. You know, that idea of you are taking feedback and trying to collaborate with the audience in a lot of ways, but if you stray so far from your own taste that you don't believe in the thing, you can't ship it with conviction either. So those are some of the hard moments where you feel like you really trust or believe that this thing is good, and it's reflected in the numbers immediately not necessarily that people don't believe that, but this is one of the big contrasting things in this world that you alluded to, is not everybody is involved for the same reasons. And that's you could say that to the purchase of anything, right? Some people buy cars because they like driving them. Some people buy them because they like how they look when they pull up to, you know, location X. So yeah, just trying to trust your own taste and produce things that you'll be proud of over a long period of time. That's the goal.
What did you think of Beanie's comment the other day or a few weeks ago? I think I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's something like Jack Butcher's not a great artist, but he's a great marketer, or something to that effect.
Yeah, No, I mean, I've tried to explain my point on this. I think so much of what this world is about in my mind is this idea of eradicating the middle party, right? And if you want to be an artist in this world and eradicate the middle party, which is traditionally the gallery or the auction house, you have to be able to market your work, get attention to your work, get people to consume it. And yeah, the idea of the subjectivity of art has been so much of what all of this work has been about in the first place. So that was like, more people got offended on my behalf than I was offended, to be honest, on that comment. It's like, there's a subjectivity to the work, but I'm not offended that you think I'm a great marketer. If that's like supposed to be an insult, then that didn't land. And I think we ended that on decent terms. I shipped a little meme in response to that. If you guys remember, yeah, it was
that was good.
An old Farouk reference. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think that's fair. Like, I think you have to be a marketer in this space. Like, I think they go hand in hand. Like, we've just spoken about how the whole dynamics work to be relevant. You could have even big artists in the traditional world have come into this space and kind of flopped. Like, yeah, they haven't got that it needs a bit more than that. You have to make a name for yourself. You need to be grabbing attention as well as some aspects of community, and also like capture. I know you say you don't want the degenerate side of stuff, but you've got to kind of capture the idea that people are here for, yeah, like the attention, the changes. All that sort of stuff. They love that. So I think you've done an incredible job of that.
Yeah, thank you. I think I think it does a huge disservice to artists that are trying to operate solely on the internet to disparage the marketing, you know, the idea of marketing your work as a negative thing. And there's obviously good and bad ways to do anything. There are things that feel overtly cringy sales pitch, or like not all marketing is created equal, right? There's an artfulness to everything. So that's the beauty of this stuff too, though. If you don't want to participate, don't participate. It's very, and the incentives to stir up shit too. It's like literally a monetary incentive to do that now. So we're going to see more and more of that. And this is like small time version of that, I guess. Like boxing, MMA, all of those environments where like you see people operating at like the highest levels of the attention economy. That's the game, for better or worse. I think there's as long as there's something that is like intrinsically you about what you're doing, I feel like, yeah, that's the key to it. It's anything that doesn't feel like you're doing it out of a just pure expression of what you're trying to get out into the world, it starts to feel wrong, and people can feel that, I think.
Awesome. Well, I think we're coming up just under an hour here. So first, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It's been awesome to have one of the breakout stars in the show, and like, it's super interesting to hear your story. And also, like, for me personally, to hear like your thought process and a bit more of like the behind the scenes stuff is great insight. But I'll end it with asking you a question we ask all of our guests, which is, and this can be in whatever context you choose it to be, what's your best advice on how not to get wrecked? How do you avoid getting wrecked?
So the immediate interpretation I have of the question is about putting work out into the world and or making certain statements, posting your ideas on the internet. And my approach to that is, how do you defend this from its worst critic? So if somebody like was gonna approach something you said with the illest intent, like what's the worst possible interpretation of this thing I'm about to say, and could I defend it from that? And obviously you're not going to understand that every single time, but if you approach it from that perspective, you could sort of bulletproof your thinking and how you would respond to, you know, somebody that would interpret what you have to say in the most negative light. And I feel as though I have, by putting that into practice, I have gotten involved in a lot less wreckages on the internet than I maybe could have.
Yeah, nice. I like that. That's interesting because it's like a slightly different perspective. Usually people are like, this is how you avoid losing money.
Well, that is true too, though, right? I think it's a byproduct of that. Yeah,
it's a byproduct of it. Yeah, probably applies to it as well. So that's awesome.